philosophers talk about the knowledge of self.
Right.
Is the key. Once one knows themselves, right, that is the key to understanding the, you know, the world, right?
You're listening to The Makeup Podcast, a truly global portrait of the art of life.
I'm on another level. This fire that I spit got me wrestling a doubt. I'm on another level. I'm on another level. This fire that I spit got me wrestling a doubt.
Paul Jeffrey of Paul Rene Furniture and Cabinetry, welcome to The Maker Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're very, very excited to have you here. I have to tell you, I did some research on you, and I found your story fascinating. I found it about 6 or 7 months ago, to be honest. But we've been so busy, we haven't been able to reach out to you. So what I'd like to do today is kind of go through your story, but I don't want to rush through it because I think it's a beautiful story. It is definitely a Phoenix Rising story. We love those stories on our podcast. And the other thing we loved about the story is that we see it as an American Dream story. I don't know how you see it, but it kind of made the American Dream look still possible. I don't know how you feel about that, but that's what we took away from it. So
yeah, I think you're right about that. It is has some American Dream type feeling and theme to it.
Yeah. So would you mind going back with us just a little bit to tell us where you were born and raised? We'll start there.
So I was born in Indianapolis, Indiana, and my parents moved to Detroit, though, when I was about 8. So we moved to Detroit in the late 70s.
Okay.
So I think I was raised in Detroit.
Okay, cool, fair enough. So the Motor City, we got that. Starting to make sense already, okay. And in terms of your education, this could be formal, informal. Did you go to university? How did you get to know what you know? Just in terms of education.
I did. Yeah, I went to a small school in Detroit, Center for Creative Studies, College of Art and Design. It was, at that time, primarily funded by the automotive industry. So it was one of three schools nationally that the automotive industry funded and recruited from. So that was its focus. It's since grown and taken on some other disciplines. But a very small school, they only graduated maybe 12 people a year in automotive design.
Okay.
And those select few would there's only 1,000 car designers in the entire world. At least there wasn't a time when I was in the business. So those select few would get some pretty prime jobs somewhere in the automotive industry.
Okay. And how did you find out that you were interested in automotive design? That's like a very, you just said it yourself, it's a very rare thing. You just said that, right? So
Yeah. Well, there was only at the time, and I'm sure it's probably true right now, maybe less than 10 black car designers in the entire world. But I stumbled upon it. My father, who went to school late in life. In fact, we went to school together. We went to the same school together. So he
for design school. Excuse me, but you went to design school with your father because he went back to school later. Is that it?
Yes, exactly.
That's
so we actually graduated together, sat right next to each other.
That's awesome.
So he took me when I graduated from high school. I joined the Army. And so when I came back from the Army 3 years later, he said, "Hey, I want to show you the school that he was attending," which I didn't know anything about. I didn't know how big this, even though it was a small school in Detroit, I didn't know how big it was in the automotive world. But I said, "Okay, let's go down and check it out." And when I went down there and I saw these amazing sketches and amazing like models of cars, futuristic designs and shapes, I was hooked. But I have to tell you, though, the reason why I didn't stay in that business is because to be a car designer, they say you have to have gasoline in your blood. And so
what does that mean?
Gift,
what does that mean?
Well, that means You got to be able to talk the talk, right? So what's under the hood?
Okay.
Is it a 450?
I got it.
650, you know, eight, so I didn't grow up around cars. It wasn't something that I loved.
Yeah.
So although I was a very, very good designer, my career was going to be limited because at a certain level, you need to know about cars.
Yes.
And how they function.
Yes.
And how they're made.
Yes.
And I just wasn't really that interested in that.
Okay. You just wanted it to look good. If it looks good, you're cool.
I was, you know, that's what you do when you're 23, 24, right? You're just into the looks of things.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it is a product that has to be made. And so that's why I jumped off the ship.
Okay. So that's your time at Ford then. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was there about 4 years.
Okay. All right. I see now. I was wondering, okay, because I was reading your story very briefly on your website. By the way, it's really well written. Did you write that story?
I did.
Definitely, you need to talk after. This is a very well-written story. That's a different topic, though. Just in terms of curiosity, there are two things I think that made me curious. I understand that you were in the military. I know you were an officer. Were you stationed in the States or someplace else? Because France is mentioned. And I'm like, okay, how did you get to France? What are we doing?
I know, it's kind of confusing.
So, no, it's not. Yeah, it's just interesting.
I was stateside. I never left the States. So I spent 3 years active duty. And then when I got out of active duty, I joined the Michigan National Guard.
Okay.
And I went to Officers Candidate School through the Guard Reserve Program. So that's how I got my commission. I spent my entire 7 years as a commissioned officer in the Reserve Program.
Gotcha. Reserve Program. Okay. Then there's a mention of you doing a design on an entrepreneurship, I think, apprenticeship in France.
Yep, in France. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This was probably, I don't know, maybe year five or six after being in the military, 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
I was a junior in college. And while I was in college studying design, I was, quote unquote, a weekend warrior.
Okay.
And so at my junior year, the end of my junior year, they have a very big party for the entire school. But it's really more for the design, automotive design school. And they bring in the top design execs from all over the world.
Okay.
They come to the school to recruit not only for permanent employment, but they come and recruit for internships.
Okay.
So I was the only, I was like one of two black students in the graduating class, as well as the underclass at that time, I think one or two. I'm at this party with all these wealthy donors and high powered execs, and I'm the only black guy there, so I'm a little isolated over in the corner, feeling a little weird.
Yeah.
But I see this gentleman come in that was dressed immaculately. It's a Caucasian man, and so the aesthetics caught my eye. Just well put together, a traditional Frenchman, right?
Yeah.
And so we locked eyes, and I couldn't take my eyes off him because he was just so well put together. Anyway,
right.
He felt that stare, and he walked over to me, and when I heard his accent, and he told me where he was from, I immediately said, before he could get anything else, when he told me where he was from, I said, can I come and internship wherever you work? Can I come internship at your company?
Yeah.
And he said, yes, but I wasn't quite sure if he heard me, so I repeated it. I said, I just want to make sure that you heard what I just said to you. I would like to come to France and internship at your company, whatever it is.
Right.
And he said, yes.
Okay.
And a few months later, he sent me a packet with a ticket and the whole nine yards.
That's fantastic. Do you know which part of France you were in? You remember exactly where you were? Where were you?
I was northern France, a little small town called Le Pen. Lepin, northern France.
Okay. I'm going to stop you.
It's a small car company. It's called Houlier Automotive. They really were a supplier to some of the bigger companies, Renault, and so, yeah.
Nice. How was that experience? Can you share it with us? Was it okay?
Oh, my God. Just, you know, as a black coming coming from a hostile, you got to fight for, you know, survival and respect, and always got to prove yourself harmless and all of that, to go to France, where much of that didn't exist, where I could just be myself. I didn't want to come back. I really did not. I had a 3-month internship. Once it ended, I begged them for another 3 months. And then once that ended, I really didn't want to go. I felt a sense of comfort. You know, there's a long history of Black Americans going over to France.
100%.
And so I felt that. I think you probably know something about that too.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. I was looking at your website and I saw, Paul Ronet. I wonder if this is a French guy, right? Because I saw you and I was like, yeah, I wonder where he's from in France. So I started doing all this research. And the funny thing is that you and I have these little things that are almost in common. Like, you're from Detroit and I grew up in Illinois, right? And you are in love with the aesthetics, and my father was a mechanic. Like, he knew everything about cars. I love cars, right?
Okay.
My whole family loves cars. Then I thought, okay, but he was in the military. Both of my parents were in the military. Then you spent time in France. Wow. I lived in France for 7 years. My husband is French. I got half French kids, the whole nine, right? So I was thinking, I was telling my husband, I wonder if I could get him to come over here and build something. I wonder if he'd come back to France.
Well, you know, it's funny. So we've been doing this for a while now, but in the last couple of years, we've actually become somewhat national. So, we're no longer just local here, but international is something that's something we fantasize about all the time.
Okay, let's fantasize about that offline. All right. Now, to get back to the story, this is going to take you to a place you probably don't want to go, but I promise to bring you out safely, okay? So. This is about you having a Ziploc bag full of pennies and dimes trying to make it. The question is, how did you get into that situation and how did you get out?
Yeah, so that really is the essence of the Paul Ronet brand, right? Our brand is a brand of transformation because that's my story. So when I got tired, I shouldn't say tired, but when it became clear to me that the car business was not my career path, my divine career path, I left, but I wanted to go somewhere warm to find what it is that I'm here to do, why I'm here, right?
Yeah.
So we had just gotten married to Renee, by the way. We just got married to Renee, and she wanted to go to New York, and I was like, I did not want to go someplace cold.
Right.
I wanted to go to L.A. She has some friends in L.A., so it was an easy sell. We went to L.A., right?
Okay.
So I go to L.A., and I just finished a stint at Ford Motor Company as a concept car designer. That's big in Detroit, right? To be a concept car is big.
Sure.
To be Black and to be in that studio is big. So I was full of myself. I thought I was God's gift to the world. I thought I could do anything. If I could get to be 1 of 10 in the entire world, I can go to L.A. and chart my own course. But L.A. was a different beast altogether. And so I like to tell people, they saw me coming as I was getting off the boat. I have to mention, I got to go back and tell you what inspired me to leave Ford Motor Company, even though this was in my mind, was the Million Man March.
Okay.
So the Million Man March was an awakening for me with regards to consciousness.
Okay.
Right. So it was there at the Million Man March that I learned that I'm responsible. We are responsible for our community. The hood is the hood because the people of talent have been pulled out of the hood and it's experiencing brain drain. So I learned that at the Million Man March. It was like, wow.
Okay.
Right? So I lived in the suburbs. My family came from the hood.
Right.
Fortunate enough to move to the suburbs. I grew up in the suburbs, completely divorced from the population of Black people who are stuck in this condition.
Okay.
So the Million Man March, all of that was taught to me.
Okay.
So when I left Ford Motor Company, I said, you know what? I'm going to go. I'm going to be that guy that's going to take my talents. I'm going to figure out a way to go back to the community and use these talents to uplift and inspire and build the community. That was my thinking.
Okay, I like it. Okay.
I didn't know anything about the hood. Nothing. I was too green. So I go to the hood and I'm trying to find organizations and whatnot and what's going on, where's the conscious community, and I'm very vocal about what I want to do. And so, you know, I'm attracting people, right? I'm attracting people who, you know, so-called are believers in the message, my cause or whatever. And so I meet this guy, and he made me believe that he was of like mind. And I had went to LA with some money in my pocket, some savings that Renee and I had.
Okay.
Pretty significant at that time in my life, 26, 27 years old. Anyway, I meet this guy, and long story short, he's got me on this investment path, right?
Mm.
He's got a way for me to, you know, take my money and flip it and yada, 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 yada.
So I'm here in Ponzi scheme. Are we going to...
Something very similar to a Ponzi scheme.
Okay,
very,
I'm so sorry. Keep going.
He knew something supposedly about currency, about trading currencies, right?
Okay.
At the time, I didn't know. Very, very high risk investment. So we opened an account. I put all this money in the account. And I'd also bought a property out there, pulled out some equity. So I was sitting on nearly six figures worth of money. I give it to this guy to manage, and within about a month, he lost everything. Everything. So,
wow.
You know, I had no foundation to deal with that kind of loss.
Yeah.
So I was psychologically devastated. I mean,
yeah.
And embarrassed, and my wife at the time didn't like this guy. She told me this guy's bad business, but I'm the guy from Detroit that just was a car designer. You know, I can do this thing. I was very arrogant, very full of myself. Her intuition said, this is no good. I don't like this guy. I'm like, hey, baby, I got this thing.
Yeah.
And a month later, we were penniless. So the love turned to bitterness, and for years, I'm talking about, I had no history to deal with not only the loss, but the disappointment in her, and then the anger that because of what I put her through.
Yeah.
On top of the loss, I mean, she really beat me up. I deserved it.
Yeah.
But I say, mentally.
Yeah.
So I was in a mess for years.
Wow.
Drug use, just the whole nine yards. I was isolated. I was in bad, 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 bad shape. And so I had to work my way through that devastation over a period of years. But the silver lining in that period was, you know, we'd been kicked out of apartments, our cars were repossessed, I mean, bankruptcy, just...
Did you have a child at the time as well?
We did. We had just had a newborn and she had come from money, so it was just the worst sort of fall for someone of our background that just didn't know anything about struggle.
Right.
We didn't know anything about struggle.
Right, you didn't have any tools for it.
Did not have any tools for it.
Yeah.
So I remember one day, I did get a job at Walgreens. Actually, it was at Rite Aid, in LA, Rite Aid.
Okay.
That was my first job. I tried to get a design job, but no one needed a car designer in California.
Okay.
So I got a job at Rite Aid, stocking shelves. So I went from car design to stocking toilet paper and Tylenol on shelves. And we had lost a car. I had to ride my bike through the rain a lot of times.
This is humbling. I'm just tired listening to you. I mean, you know, I love this story, though. I am not cutting you off. I'm encouraging you to tell every detail you want. It is a beautiful story. I feel you. Been there, unfortunately, you know. But,
yeah.
Okay, so I'm riding this bike with you now, and I got no money.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I had to put on some sweatsuits. It'd be raining. I had to strap my my suit to the rail of the bike and tied with a belt, and my shoes were dangling from that middle rail, and I'm paddling in the rain or whatever at 2-3 in the morning coming back home. This went on for a year or so. We were down in one car. We had a newborn, so Renee had to keep the car. So anyway.
Wow.
One
no.
Day,
wow.
So here's where I hit rock bottom. This is the pivotal point in my
life. Okay.
And I like to think that my story was really, I had to go through this.
Yes.
So one day, Renee came home and like many days, there was so much tension in the air.
Yeah.
And again, we were struggling back to the bag of pennies, nickels, and dimes, you know. Rite Aid was not paying enough for us to live in L.A.
Yeah.
And she had to stay at home with the newborn because we couldn't afford daycare.
Right.
So we were on, you know, an assistant manager's salary in L.A. You're not going to make it. You're just not going to make it in L.A. like that.
Sure.
So, you know, whatever we could scrape together to get some eggs and some oatmeal or whatever, right? So one day, she had just had enough of me, and she really started just lighting me up and telling me about myself. Stuff that I really needed to hear, right?
Yeah.
About how, you know, stuff like, you know, you're really not the man that you think you are. I trusted you, yada, 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 yada. You're just full of a bunch of bluff and puff. I mean, really striking me at my core.
Sure.
So that evening was so painful. This was probably like 1999, maybe 2001. And we were sitting in the living room, and she was going at it. And I got up from this couch, and I just had to go to the bathroom. I was experiencing pain that I had never experienced before.
Mm.
And I could barely walk to the bathroom. The bathroom maybe was, I don't know, maybe 30 or 40 feet along this narrow hallway. And I'm having to, like, grab the edge of the walls. I was hurting that bad. She had really broken me down to nothing. So I'm walking to the bathroom, like crying. I'm crying and just holding myself. I go in the bathroom. I close the door. I lock the door. I'm sitting on the stool, and I'm crying like torrents of rain tears. I'm talking about just, right?
Yeah.
And so just mucus coming out of me, and I somehow, something lifted me. I can't say that I did it. I was in so much pain. Lifted me off of the stool. I walked over to the mirror in the bathroom. I looked up, and I didn't recognize myself. I had been crying so hard.
Mm.
And I mean, just a mess. My face was red.
Mm.
And I looked in the mirror, and I'm shaking. And I say to myself, these words came out of my mouth. I couldn't have said it myself. These words came out of my mouth. And I said, she's right. I am not the guy, the man that I think I am. I've been pretending. And my knees are shaking, my teeth, when those words came out, as God is my witness, a load of pressure came off of me. I was at rock bottom, but I had clarity in that moment of who I am, who I am not. I had clarity in that moment.
Mm.
And so the pressure of pretending, trying to be something that I'm not, trying to project far beyond what I am, you know, all of that was gone. I was stripped naked. And at that point, I knew what I had to do. So at that point is when the slide stopped. I realized that I didn't have enough knowledge to do what I went to LA to do. I realized that my whole concept about God and all of that, I knew all of that information was insufficient, was half false, and I had to go back to ground zero.
Yeah.
And start to find some truth. And so I started reading all sorts of books about metaphysics, about thoughts. I started really getting into Black history long before slavery. I was isolated. I didn't have any friends. My wife wasn't you know, she didn't care for me. I was a loser. All of my little middle class friends that I even met in LA, no one wants to be around a loser. I was angry, I was bitter, so I was isolated. So for a period of several years, I just studied, and I read.
What did you read, Paul? What would you read, for example? Give me, like, what do you mean?
Oh, my God.
In terms of, like, the, you know, the mind shift, the mindset kind of books.
There is a book by Napoleon Hill called The Law of Success.
Okay.
It's a very thick book called The Law of Success. There's some books by Deepak Chopra, The Seven Spiritual Laws of Success. Some of the big books that, again, if you were to go to the local Barnes & Noble and you know, maybe Google all time self-help books, Think and Grow Rich, How to Influence People. I started reading my Bible, my Quran, but I read them this time. I didn't, because I grew up in a church where you just went and someone preached to you and you clapped and you sang a song and you walked out and you thought you were holy. And I went and read those books, but I read them this time with a dictionary. I would read, starting in Genesis, with a dictionary, and I'd read, look up every word. And so, for example, if it says, I'm just giving a random example, God is love. I look up the word God. I look up the source of what the root word of that, what God, I looked it all up. What is, was, and love, there are so many definitions of love. And when I was stringing together all the definitions of God, all of the definition of is, all of the definition of love, it just expanded my mind beyond basic, fundamental. And I did those with every book that I read. I fell in love with the dictionary.
That's it. That's what it is. I was looking at this work and I said, okay, here's another thing. So already we got the military thing going on. We have the Midwest going on. We got automobiles. And I was in San Francisco for a number of years, and I started an interior design firm. So I started thinking about design for like 8 years, and I left it because I'm the opposite of you. The only thing I love and care about is words. So since I've been a child, I read dictionaries and I take apart words. That's why I said, did you write that piece? Because it's really well written. Like, this is a person who knows how to craft things, right? If you can craft one thing, you can craft almost anything. It's a thought process. You know what I mean?
I had a college degree. In fact, I had 2 degrees. I thought, this is where we get ourselves in trouble, particularly Black Americans, or probably Blacks or anybody all over the world. We come out of these schools with these degrees, but it's training. We're taught to repeat, but we don't really understand it enough to use it as leverage.
Right.
Use this knowledge as leverage to move things, to move people, to think through, you know, our ideas.
Yes.
And think it through the end where we can say, oh, that's not going to work. That's half-baked. I got to go back.
Right.
So at the end of that long, long period of remaking myself, again, I was completely isolated.
Yes.
So at a certain point, I began to get some legs back under me again.
Yes.
Because I was in my head.
Right.
I became curious about, I was like a little child again. I became curious about the world and people, and I would meet people and, what is your story and what do you do and tell me more about what you do, and yeah, so the world of information, of knowledge, lifted me out of, you know, when I was in LA, I spent some time in jail.
Really? Tell us why. Do you want to tell us why?
I gotta go back. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
So this is a true story. So again, you know, my home life was just horrible.
Hmm.
Again, my ex came from affluence.
Yeah.
Her parents didn't know we were struggling. So they didn't know we were struggling until I had to just go to them one day and tell them. I had to fly to Phoenix one day and tell them. But we had been in a 7-year slide at that point. So anyway, one day she'd come home. We're in L.A. And it was just one of those times. She was just going going off on me.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it got kind of tense there where this is right. This is during the O.J. The O.J.
Okay.
This is right after O.J.
Okay.
So at that time, a spouse could just call. The law was, it was like, I don't know if it's the legal system, but there was some law that was, or institute. It wasn't quite law, but it was another term, that if a woman felt threatened, she, all she had to do was call the police, and the police, without question, had to remove the man from the house.
Okay.
This was just a few weeks after OJ.
Okay.
So, again, she called the police on me. They removed me from the house. This was like a 4th of July weekend, a long weekend. So the courts were closed on Friday. They were closed on Monday. I went in on Thursday afternoon to the L.A. County Jail. Again, middle-class boy from Detroit.
Yeah.
I'm in a L.A. County Jail.
Yeah.
With guys that were career, you know, recidivists.
Yeah.
I saw the worst of Black America. I'm talking about Bloods and Crips. Guys that, they were big. I mean, they had muscle because, you know, in prison you just work out. They had tattoos all over their face. I mean, these guys looked scared. They were like animals. I'm in this room, this gray, dingy room. There must have been 100 bunk beds, too tall. The mattress was filthy. There was no sheets on one wall. There was just a whole row of stainless steel toilets. No stalls, no doors. You're in this room. I was in that place for 5 days. I could not eat the food. I didn't even recognize the food. What, I didn't know what it, the colors were weird looking. I was in that place. So one, my first day there, and I'm you know, I'm 150 pounds clean cut. I was set up to be a victim in there.
Yeah.
And so one day, you know, sort of a crowd randomly kind of found themselves around me in this cell, and I was just afraid, and so they're looking at me, and I knew at that moment I'd better man up, because, you know, this is the prison, and,
yeah,
you know, it's all about manhood in here,
right?
And I had to find something deep within, and I was blessed to find enough to keep these dudes at bay for 4 or 5 days until I was able to go in front of the judge on Tuesday, and I was let out. There was no evidence. There was no police report. So anyway, that was part of that. That was part of that experience. So back to that now. I mean, that knowledge, me really becoming curious again, and you know, trying to understand again. You know, when the great philosophers talk about the knowledge of self,
right,
is the key. Once one knows themselves, right, that is the key to understanding the, you know, the world, right?
Yeah.
So that fall taught me who I was, not just the good, because we tend to exaggerate the good, right? I exaggerated the good.
Yeah.
I'm a this, I'm a that, I got this degree, yada, 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 yada. But did I know the bad? Did I know my weaknesses? Did I know my limitations?
Right.
That fall taught me all of that. So again, one of the other books that I learned coming back up is I read a lot of military history.
Okay, that's interesting.
I realized living in the ghetto, we had to move to the ghetto.
Yeah.
We had to move amongst, we could not afford to live in Echo Park, and we had to move amongst, you know, the low rent district.
Right.
To survive amongst that element, even though I come from the military, I had to learn to think more like hunters and gatherers, because on the bottom, when people are scrapping for food every day,
mm-hmm,
they'll kill you over some food because they got to eat. People got to eat.
Right.
So I studied lots lots of books on military warfare, military thinking.
What did you read, for example? What's the top one that you can think of?
The one that I can think of right now is called The 33 Laws of Warfare. It's by a guy named, the same guy that wrote The 48 Laws of Power and The Art of Seduction. I think his name is...
I know who you're talking about. I can't think of his name, but
it's a big book. I would recommend that book. He also, the author of that book, also wrote a book with 50 Cent called The 50th Law. Phenomenal insight into the way the world really works, because I was grew up to think that it's about fairness, it's about merit.
Right.
You go to school, you work hard, you get a degree, you can make it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's such a myth. You do have to go to school. You do have to have some knowledge. But there's a whole nother layer of reality.
Right.
Of how things work that we cannot see.
Right.
The competitive landscape, the competitive reality that trumps merit.
Yes.
If I want something, right?
Yeah.
And 10 other people want it, at a certain level, it's not about who's the smartest. It's about who is the craftiest.
Right. Have you ever read Sun Tzu? The Art of War?
Oh, my God. That's got that book, too. Read that book, too.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I can't think of a lot of the books that I
No, that's fine.
Read.
That's fine. I'm just trying to sort of check out, you know, where you're coming from.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite books.
I have to say this, too.
Yeah.
That's a great book. That
brilliant.
Is
brilliant. I read it, like, every day. I read a little piece of it, and just for no reason, just in case.
Would you say you read it because you find some value on some level, right?
Of course.
So.
Exactly. So. 100%. So it's all about, you can have an encyclopedic knowledge of things, but if you don't apply them to anything, the information is useless. Right?
If you don't apply it to anything, it is useless. It's just data.
Exactly.
It's just data.
That's right.
So let me mention another thing, too, that was instrumental.
Yes, go.
So at that time, I also became I discovered Malcolm X during that period of time. Again, when I went to the Million Man March, that was the first time that I had become familiar with Malcolm, the Nation of Islam. It was the first time.
Okay.
So during that period of time, I read a lot of Malcolm's, his autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
Life-changing, a little life-changing.
Sure.
I read Message to the Black Man. I read everything from the books on, really got to know my brother, Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
So a lot of the great, I needed to know how these men were able to stand up against the odds, overwhelming odds. What made these men willing to face death and still keep going? Because I was in a death-like state.
Right.
And I was searching for knowledge from anybody and everything that could help me.
Sure.
To regain my respect, to get back to a state. And I have to tell you this, what really impelled me, that's why the name of the business is called Paul Rene, because it was Rene. One day I told her, I said, you know what, I'm going to prove to you. When I hit rock bottom in that bathroom, shortly thereafter, I told her, I'm going to prove to you that I can be that man that you want me to be. That is what sent me looking for that knowledge. It was my desire to regain, solely my desire to regain the respect of Renee.
Mm.
Solely.
She's still your wife? She's still with you? You're still together?
No, it's funny. After the business came up, we had just grown apart. So not only do we have to suffer that period in L.A., but to be an entrepreneur, you know, you have to be in it.
Yeah.
100%. And I didn't have any money. So by the time we got up, we didn't really know each other anymore.
Gotcha.
So we're very good friends still. She is a writer, by the way. She lives in Seattle. We have two children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're allies now.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, the marriage did not, 2000 and, I want to say nine.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2009, we got divorced.
But, you know, not to minimize the situation, I think sometimes in life people come for a season and you take it for what it is. You see what I'm saying?
No question.
And you have to respect the conscious uncoupling, if you want to call it that.
No question. So, again, back to my studies, I learned during that period of time coming up that Renee meant rebirth.
Yeah.
Rebirth. So what you said, I come to see the same way.
Yeah.
This woman was divinely sent to cause a transformation in me.
Right.
And what drives me today is purpose. But I cannot do what we do today. What today would not have happened without Renee in my life. It would not have happened without the LA experience. It would not have happened without that.
That's a beautiful story. That's a beautiful story. That takes us to the concrete of this whole concept. I'm looking at the work you do, the pieces that you create, which for me are natural, very natural and organic in appearance. I haven't seen any of them in real life, but they have a feel to them that it goes beyond the aesthetic, like they're infused with something almost mystical. So I think if you could explain a little bit about how you come to the aesthetics, because they're also, for me, very African in influence, or I'm just inventing that, but that's what I see.
Well, I think there's probably some truth to that. I can't say that that's necessarily done consciously, but we are born, right? The root of us, of all of us dark people, comes from a certain, we have the same origin.
Right.
So I believe that, you know, as I have become more familiar with my origin and embrace it and seek to express from that, I think it makes sense that people recognize it. But it's my step in the oneness of the universe. It's all a part. It's the yin and the yang, the black and the white, the struggle and the smooth, the light and the dark, the salt and the, there's a oneness. And so everything fits the divine, the creator's idea of unity on some level. I can't say that I've certainly mastered that. My design, I'm always trying to create seamless transitions from a horizontal to a vertical, maybe to an angle. I'm trying to create from the front of the piece to the side of the piece to the back. I'm trying to move your eye around this entire piece.
Right.
That's at the root of our aesthetic, but it comes from my understanding of the oneness of the universe.
There you go. There you go. Again, this is coming from my perception. This is from a woman who's only seen your things on paper. I can feel that, all that on paper, like it's infused with something. It's not just a piece of furniture, like a thing that you get from IKEA, or a thing that a man sat down and drew a square with four legs on it. Here you go. It's infused with something special, and that's a gift. I need you to know that. That's a gift. It comes across.
Thank you. Oh, thank you. And you know what? It has taken me, you know, they say to get to know oneself is a lifelong journey, because we're always evolving.
Yes.
And so I cannot tell you that when I first got in this business, I started out with that thinking. I got in this business because I was hungry and I needed some place to apply my, but as I began to evolve, as I began to understand, you know, the market, how I fit in the market.
Yeah.
There are a million chair options out there, right? You can go to IKEA and get a chair if that's what you want.
Right.
So I cannot compete in a space where you know, furniture at some level is really a commodity. It's not like the iPhone at some point where it's life changing.
Right.
Where you know, at one point you went and got an encyclopedia, but now you can get on your phone. No, it's a chair, and it's been around forever.
Yeah.
So if I'm going to sell furniture, how am I going to operate in this space?
Right.
Particularly when our stuff is handmade, I can't afford $1 million robotics and all of that stuff that the big players. How am I going to fit in a space where it's handmade and charge something that's going to allow me to eat and all of the guys to live on a livable wage?
Right.
I learned it's about the narrative. It's about the story. This is not a chair. This chair has meaning to it. So for you to say that you're picking up some of the meaning, you know, it makes me feel good because it tells me that I'm beginning to understand how to infuse in products.
Yes.
And a lot of products, we end up, this is a side note, we end up throwing so much material away. We've become so materialistic because we throw it away because it has no meaning.
Yes. Yes. I completely agree with that.
For a season, yes. And we just throw it away.
Yes.
Polluting the earth.
Yes. So, yes. This makes sense to me because what I'm looking at is this. Again, I'm going to put this together like this for you. Coming from this design aesthetic in San Francisco, I got this eye from France. I spent a lot of time in France, right? I got deeply involved in antiques, so I learned all about the history of all these different kinds of furniture. And you can feel the difference when you're in the room with furniture that's been around for a bit, and you're in a room with furniture that was made yesterday, or you're in a room with furniture that was made yesterday but with meaning. Those are three different
things. Absolutely.
Three different things.
Absolutely.
Right?
Because it's the spirit. It's like when you go eat food that your mama cooks.
Yes.
Right? Your mom knows how to make a hamburger.
Yes.
Or you can go to McDonald's and get a hamburger.
Right.
But the spirit of mom's love as she is, you know, mashing that burger, turkey burger, whatever.
Yeah.
Her spirit, her mindset is in that food.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
Mama, this is great.
Yes.
And it's the same with our work. We are passionate about what we do.
Yes.
We are so privileged coming from where I came from, destitute.
Yeah.
I am so grateful. Most of my customers do not look like me.
Mm.
99% of my customers are wealthy Caucasian people.
Okay.
I am so grateful.
Yeah.
For their trust and commitment. Some of our chairs cost $6,000. A lady bought 6 of them last year.
Yeah.
For someone to see that value.
Right.
And Paul Jeffrey to buy 6.
Yeah.
I am so utterly grateful. So when we go into the shop and we're crafting, I'm trying to explain to my guys.
Yeah.
Right? This lady, customer has choice.
Yeah.
But she sees something in us, and we had better not disappoint her expectation.
Yep. Yep.
And this has allowed a black man in America, and we're like rising stars now. And I don't say that arrogantly. We are really in this environment, we in our profession at the high end, our star is rising right now.
I can
and
see that.
So, but we do not, again, the fall calls great humility. I know that as you can rise and you can fall.
Right.
So when someone gives me a check, I struggle. I sometimes don't sleep.
Mm-hmm.
We seek perfection.
Yeah.
And that attitude has caused people has attracted people towards us.
Yeah.
Excellent. So when you told me, back to your original email, right?
Right.
Showcasing black excellence.
Yeah.
That language alone resonated with me.
Yeah. That's good. That's what we're looking for. We only want people who understand that. And I have the sneaking suspicion that you didn't deep dive into who we are and what we do. Is this correct?
I, 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 I didn't do a deep dive. I think it probably took me 3 or 4 days to even respond to your email, right?
I know, but you were busy.
So I clicked on a couple of links. In fact, one day at lunchtime,
yeah,
I went and clicked on a link.
Yeah.
And your website came up this beautiful photograph of this black man as a boxer and those colors. And so I'm in between appointments and I'm kind of flicking up and down and I'm
right.
reading a little bit, get a little bit about your history.
Right.
But for like a 10-minute podcast.
Yeah.
It was a YouTube video.
Right.
Where you had a couple guys. And so, but it was not a deep dive.
Right.
But enough to know, I was like, yeah, I want to be a part of this.
That's what I want to hear. It's the funniest thing because I'll tell you a little bit. The thing is, most of the people who come on my podcast, they go, no, it's cool. I got the vibe from your email, right? And I'm like, I would never do that. I would never step into somebody's universe like, it's cool. I got the vibe from your email. But I'll tell you, after this podcast, someone very important asked me, how do you get all these people to say yes to you? And I said, I'm authentic. It is what it is. Like the me that you see right now is what I am in the universe, and it resonates with the correct people. That's it. That's all I can say to you. I cannot sell that to you because this person was trying to figure out how to get special people to connect with him. And I said that you can't have what I have unless you have what I have. So
absolutely.
The fact that you stepped out on faith and came into the Maker universe, I'm very, very pleased.
Oh, no, listen, and you're 1,000% right. If a person doesn't get the message, it's not free. When I saw black, I said, yes, yes. Because it gets back to this original mission, right?
Right.
The Million Man March, where I said, I need to go back to the community and be an example. And I live in a community even today. You know, we make enough to do a little better, but I need for the little brothers and sisters in the community to see me drive down the street in the morning, see me come back. I like to walk through the neighborhood a lot of time.
Yeah.
And you can tell they look at me as like somebody strange, but they need to see me. They need to see black excellence, because if you want to be a doctor, you need to see a doctor.
Yes.
And we're all just one example.
Right.
At my level, I'm one example away from being motivated to go to the next level.
Yes. Exactly. 100%. So, okay. I read that you received the Design Icon Award in 2018. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
How did that feel?
Thank you. Oh, Lord have mercy. You know, I left Ford Motor Company in 1995. So, you know, some of the story, right? And so, there were many dark days throughout this journey where we did it with nothing. We did it with pennies, nickels, and dimes. Again, we didn't have, I've had no bank loans, none of that, right? So, to be recognized, the gentleman that runs that program is an icon himself in the Phoenix, Scottsdale, and I think on the national scene. He is a big, well-respected designer, and he owns this magazine called Sources for Design. It's a trade magazine, and so it's the institution here, and so I had joined, let me just go back a little bit. So
sure.
I had, again, talk about angels along the path, people along the path that are sent to you. So I had met a black interior designer maybe 4 years ago who was a part of ASID. Maybe you're familiar with American Society of Interior Designers. I met this lady one day at a dialogue where I was just going to go see if I wanted to be part of this organization.
Right.
So I met this sister, and she saw my work. She said, you need to join the organization. And I said, yes, I will. Yes, I will. I never did. And I see her around from time to time. You need to join the organization. Yes, I will. Yes, I will. Yes, I will. Right.
Never but she did. Didn't, right?
But I just, you know, just busy, and I did. So right. I saw her maybe 18 months ago.
Yeah.
I saw her out, and Lord of me, and she was angry with me. She was like, I am sick and tired of telling you, you need to join this organization. So she said it in such a way that I felt embarrassed, and I said, I will. So I joined the organization. She said, you need to submit some of your work to the design contest. This is what she told me the last time I saw her. I said, okay, I said, okay, I promised her I would. I joined the organization. 6 months later, they had their annual design contest.
Okay.
I submitted 3 pieces to the design contest. The award ceremony was last August. It was last August, about, I don't know, whatever that was, 9 months ago. Last August. August of 2018.
Okay.
So we won, for the categories that we submitted, we won 2 out of the 3 categories. So everybody, there's anybody in this business in Arizona goes to that ceremony.
Okay.
Everybody, there's anybody. It's a big event. It's a gala. It's at that ceremony. So it's all tradespeople. At that ceremony, we were introduced to the biggest players in the market here locally. It's like, who are these guys? And I took a table full of my team. We were the only black people in the entire event. I took like 8 black people. I said, I'm taking all y'all because I don't want to go here by myself and be the spot in the middle. I need y'all because I'm really a shy person.
Yeah.
And I don't like crowds.
Sure,
so,
sure.
Listen, I bought tickets for everybody. We took up a whole table.
Nice.
Emotional support. So we got
Yes, of course.
And so at that award ceremony was the owner of this magazine.
Yeah.
And he called me, it happened on a Friday, on a Saturday, he called me the following Monday. And he said, I'm so-and-so-and-so-and-so. I knew who he was. I'm like, what? I'm so-and-so-and-so-and-so-and-so. And I saw you at the award ceremony. I have to tell you, I'm so impressed. I'd like to come to your studio and yada, yada, yada. I was like, sure. He came by. And he said, you know what? After he got to know me, he said, I want to give you an award, design icon. And so it was like,
what?
I didn't cry in front of this man.
It was
like the moment where I could exhale.
Yeah.
Because it was like all of the pain and the suffering, it made sense.
Yeah. Yep.
I became grateful for it.
Right. 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 Right.
I could never, again, like back to what you said. I can't make people to see. I'm not a salesman. I don't get on the table and say, hey, we got the cold as ice. I'm not that type of person.
Right.
My work needs to speak for me.
Yes.
And so it did.
Yes.
Like your words spoke to, my work spoke to those people.
Yes.
And I got that award. And since then, I mean, we've just been on this upward trajectory, and we've gotten so busy now that this is insider information. I don't even answer. We don't even answer the business phone anymore.
Oh, man. I'll cut that part out of the podcast then.
Listen, we make people leave a message. If you want, because people call and want stuff, but, you know, to be honest with you, I can't really, I haven't got to the point where I can afford my own stuff. I have 2 children, so I can't justify $6,000 chairs yet. My son is a freshman in college. I got to, you know,
yes.
I got child support, so I can't justify that. So we've gotten so busy where people will call us and they want the product, but, you know, no, it's you have to go to, you know, you have to go to IKEA if you want that, right?
Right.
We can't give it away.
Right.
But it has helped our brand.
Yes.
If you want us, you will leave a message.
Yeah.
And those that want us, leave a message.
I like that.
Get back to
that. I like that. It's up to you if I cut that out of the podcast or not. This is still going.
It's up to you. I'm just telling you. You can do it. I'm just telling you the truth.
I think it's kind
of
dope, though.
Arrogance.
It's dope, though, because look, man, look. You are selling excellence. Excellence is not a free thing, okay? It didn't come to you for free, so you can't give it away for free. It goes back to self-love and value and that kind of a thing. And the funny thing that you said was if you want the product, you have to leave a message, right? So almost like what you get from the angels or the universe or God or whatever you want to call it. That's how you get information that's of the finest quality. They leave you a message, right?
They leave you a message.
That's it.
Right. Yes, that's it.
That's it. So
that's it.
I suggest we leave that in. It's kind of cool.
I didn't know at the time. No, I did it out of fatigue, right? I was like, you know what?
Yeah.
I don't want to pay somebody to sit at the desk here, answer the phone all day.
Sure.
And then me and my team, we got to go through and call through this list and figure out who's qualified. Let's just let the market self-edit themselves. If you don't leave a message, then I know you're not for us.
Right.
If you find that rude, unprofessional, I get it.
Exactly.
But the ones who want it, they leave a message.
I mean, it's all there. You're saying it again. Like, that's it. You know, you've heard people say, I got the call. Like, you got the call in your bathroom that day, sitting on that stool. You got the call and you picked up. Right? That's what this is about. If you're serious, you'll pick up. If they're serious, they'll hear it. I think your people will find you. Your right people will find you. I found you, right?
Yeah. That's my God. When I was like, how in the world? And I have to ask you, were you here? Did you do a search here? Were you searching?
No.
From?
No, I wasn't. I'm sitting right here in my apartment in Amsterdam where I'm sitting right now. Okay? And I have this kind of like a meditative state that I go into, and I'm looking for information from the internet. This is not mystical. It's just how I work. So people always go like, how do you find these people? They kind of find me, but via. Nobody told me about you. I was looking for a specific category of black excellence I want to add to this magazine. And I found you that way. You're the first person that came up. Like, nobody else came up. Nobody else came up. I didn't compare you to six people. I didn't compare you to three people. It was like that one, that guy. And I just read. And I go. And I could feel it. I was like, yeah, that's the guy. That's the man that we want. It was like that.
Wow.
Seriously.
Wow. No, that's divine again, because I was... I mean, so this year we got a client in Canada found us.
Okay.
And he was in Canada. He searched. He found me. But he has a house here, and we did some nice pieces for this guy. So again, we had been thinking internationally. That had been my thought. So when you came, I was like, I mean, those thoughts are my thoughts are traveling around the universe now. They're
exactly.
Out there now.
Exactly. That's a known thing. But again, that's like some offline stuff. That's why I always end up with so many people. Like, I have this thing called after talk. It goes deep. But I have two questions for you, one comment, and we're done. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So the question is this. I read on your website that you said your work symbolizes struggle and transformation. Okay? Can you just talk to us a little bit about that? You already have, but sum that up for us. Struggle and transformation symbolized by your work.
Yes, yeah, so I'll start with the frontage of work right at first. So we work with organic materials. You know, we work with wood, and so wood, you know, the properties of wood. It you know, this thing is alive. It wants to do its own thing.
Yeah.
So it takes a craftsman. Let's call it a wood whisperer, right? A wood whisperer to be able to get this thing to bend and twist and express a certain and we don't always know. When I sell something, I sell with a sketch. So if you go on the process page, you're going to see a blue sketch. That's how I sell. Back to the automotive days, if you couldn't sell your ideas with a sketch, people don't want to hear you talk when you're trying to sell design. If you can't describe what you want with a sketch, you're not going to be successful.
Okay.
So you have to be a good sketcher. So I sell with sketches. But a lot of times my guys have no idea. And many times I don't think about how we're going to make it.
Okay.
When I'm sketching it and when I'm selling it. I do not. However, because of my background and my understanding, this little spiritual knowledge that, you know, in the beginning, according to the Bible, there was nothing.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
And God created all that you see from nothing. That concept makes me to believe I can take this wood or anything else that I found. It's just a mindset.
Yes.
And make something from nothing. Give value to things that may not have any value. So that is the mindset that I give my... And there have been many things that I've given to these guys. They're like, we can't make it. I'm like, well, you're going to have to make it because I got the check. In fact, your paycheck last week, that came from that check we just bought. So you cannot...
Right.
That is not an answer, right? But again, so... if I had not have known
right. That
the divine made from me,
yeah,
from my nothingness state, I didn't know 25 years ago when I was sitting in that jail cell that I would be here.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Right.
I knew I had a talent.
Right.
And I knew that I had a purpose. I didn't know furniture. That's not something that I grew up dreaming about. Yes. I didn't know.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So, from someone who was medicated and isolated and hated himself and
all
of that.
Yeah.
To this point, I understand the process of transformation now.
Yeah.
I understand how the divine, like a blacksmith, he takes a piece of metal and he puts it in fire.
Yeah.
And heats it up. He puts fire on his metal to get red, and you bring it out, and then you beat this thing with a hammer into shape, then you put it in water and cool it, and then you put it back in the fire.
Yes.
And this is how God makes men and women of substance. The fire is necessary. The pain of life, struggle, things outside of our reach.
Yes.
That God makes us to stretch out. And in that stretching out is pain, and there is doubt, and all of the emotions, the negative emotions, you and I will have to experience and conquer and overcome and break through to where we can become really masters of ourselves.
Yes.
And make ourselves into the person, the man or the woman that we see in our mind. But unless we're willing to go through the fight, embrace, that's a part of it on every level. To get from zero to 10, to get to that 10 stage, you're really going back to zero again. Go from zero to 10, right?
Yeah.
And then you'd be on the second level. You got to go back to, on whatever level, you're going back to zero again.
Always.
Except you're on the 30th level.
Exactly.
And you're going back to zero. Now you're on the fourth level.
Right.
You got to go back to zero. So we have to embrace the yin and the yang, the dark and the light.
Yes.
And unfortunately, that knowledge has been erased from the public sphere, and we think that with a little information, life is going to be easy.
It's not easy.
Heaven is at the top of the mountain.
Yes, exactly. It's not easy, and it's okay that it's not easy, but again, all of us as humans, I think, particularly in the Western world, if you want to be honest, this is my opinion, we've been convinced, and we've convinced ourselves that we don't need the beginner's mind. You need the beginner's mind. You need the beginner's mind. You must. Right? Now, I got one more question for you, and then one comment which I really want to share with you. So the question is, what is next for Paul Rene in 2019? Can you share the big plans? What you got?
Well, you know, we have been, we have tried over the last several years. Again, our shop is in the hood, and we're committed to staying, I shouldn't use the word hood, but the disadvantaged, if you will, community. I live amongst the disadvantaged, our shop is there. And we, you know, there's this old thing about if you build a better mousetrap, people will come. But we have found that to be true. Our clients will come off these mountaintops, these 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 square foot houses in their Bentleys, and come to the
mountaintop
and see us, right? This
right,
is the
right.
truth. I'm not exaggerating.
Wow.
But the reason why we stay there, again, is because we want to be an example, but we want to recruit. I mean, manufacturing has been lost.
Yeah.
We used to be the manufacturers.
Yeah.
In the, you go back 400 years, we were the blacksmiths. We were the carpenters. The slaves built the country. But today, all of that knowledge has been lost to Black America. We cannot make anything. We consume everything. But manufacturing is the bedrock of the middle class. It is what produced the middle class. Henry Ford hired poor people to make his products, paid them enough money so they could buy his product, and that created the middle class. Well, the middle class today is wiped out because manufacturing has gone overseas. It's in China and Indonesia. So not only the black middle class that came up via Detroit to the car industry, but the white middle class has been completely wiped out. Well, I'm the child of a manufacturer. My dad worked with his hands.
Yeah.
He put me through college with his hands. So I watched the demise of the Detroit auto industry. I watched the demise of the black middle class in Detroit, a very strong community 25, 30, 40 years ago, very strong community, middle class community. It's all gone now. I watched that. So part of my assignment really has nothing to do with furniture. I believe my ultimate purpose is to help restore manufacturing back to our community, to those who are not made to go to college, those who have a craft, who know how to take nothing and craft it into something of value. That is my ultimate purpose. So we have tried to bring people in off the streets and put a tool in their hands, but we've come to realize that their negatives are so high and so overwhelming that we really cannot trust them to with $1,000 boards of exotic woods that we can't trust. So we have to open a school.
Okay.
We have to open a carpentry school, and it is our, before I die, I am going to make that happen. Again, the furniture is a vehicle that I ride on to be, again, to teach our people how to produce what we consume.
Okay.
That's my ultimate purpose. And I don't share that story with too many people. It's perfect to share with you, but I don't share that with my customers necessarily.
Right.
But that is really what drives me every day. It's a sense of obligation.
Okay.
If who is going to fix it? If I don't fix it, can we depend on someone from the outside to come and care about our children?
No, we cannot. We should not.
We cannot, and unfortunately we still have that kind of thinking.
Right.
Government do something for me. We're all one, we're all Americans. I think they've proved to us that the law of nature is self-preservation first. Everyone got to take care of their own first. And the Western world is having a hard time now taking care of themselves. So they have to let everybody else go.
Yeah.
We've been let go.
Yeah.
And so we're left now to do for self. But we got it within us. That's in our DNA.
Yes. Yes.
But someone has to go down in that space and say, you're the blood of my blood, the flesh of my flesh. I'm going to transfer this knowledge to you. I'm going to sacrifice my life and transfer. So we start a movement of economic independence. That's really at the root of what we do.
That's a perfect place to stop. So now this is the comment that I want to make to you, and I just need you to hear this, okay?
Yes.
First things first. Paul Jeffrey, Paul Rene Furniture and Cabinetry, thank you so much for sharing a bit of your Sunday again. And thank you for sharing the elegant work you're doing in the universe and for beautifying the universe with your hands. Thank you so much
thank
for that.
You.
And thank you for joining the Maker Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for finding me. I thank God for you. I really do, because the diaspora has to come together. We got within our community globally. What do we not know? We know everything we need to know, but we need need people like you. You're a connector to connect us. Connect Africa with Black America and wherever we are found all over the globe. Thank you.
Thank you so
Wonderful
much.
Wonderful service.
Thank you so
Absolutely.
Much. Stay with me, okay? Don't move.
Okay. Okay.
Got me wrestling the doubt. I'm on another level. This fire that I spit, got me wrestling the doubt.
I ain't broke no more. ETA got me paid now. And I'm at my maximum potential. No more minimum wage now. My whole flow a grenade now. Every bar that I spit cut sharp like a blade now. Lost bras give me play now. Full of thirst, I don't hit them, I just surf from the wave now. I've been working like a slave now. My partners catching plays cause they tired of looking for a way out. My mama see me on the stage now. A long way from the days when I laid on that bass couch. Look at how it all played out. Told my homies who know me we about to be global. From the hood but can't stay out. I keep OGs with me half the time like T-Mobile. I ain't really hella social. My supporters, they know how I move cause they follow. Turn my circle to an oath. Cause some boys like four quarters, they change for $1. Holler, young black and a scholar. Probably could've went to Oxford. They tryna kick it like soccer. My mama still tryna get me to be a doctor. I told her, I'm on another level. I'm on another level.
This vibe that I spit, got me wrestling it down.
I told my mama her neck and fingers finna be freezing. For sure. Cause I go off the deep end for all them nights she was weeping. Huh. All them tears she was leaking. Uh-huh. Days that we wasn't speaking straight up. Tell a hater to get his weight up. Yeah. Uncle the noble pass, but before he left, got me prayed up. That's probably why I stayed up. Caught the rhythm and cadence. My papa told me do right and angels gon' celebrate us. Look,
I be crashing the mic, but I do it for all of my dogs. Whoa. Whoa. I remember when we stayed in Winfield and washing my drawers. Oh. The OG J Slim did a bit cause he clapped at the laws. True. But from where I'm from, we hear claps like it's round of applause. Ooh. Bars 3D like the Dudleys. I keep it real.
For sure.
My cousin say he bloody and keep the steel. I offended little buddy. I said, be for real. Tell me one gangster that you know live with his auntie still. Boy, you trippin' on maps. Slap the blood out your mouth if you say big and back. Being bull one more time, you ain't trappin'. You trapped every cage bird. Don't sing some of them just the death. Boy, God.
I'm on another level.
I'm on another level.
This fire that I spit got me wrestling the doubt.
I'm on another level.
This fire that I spit got me wrestling the doubt.
Turn up.